You know, sometimes you fry your voice trying to do a funny 2010s Let's Player impression. And on the one hand, it is funny in the moment. But on the other, I just can't stop. Welcome back, everybody, to Independent Incidentals. Here's your host, Dominic. How you guys doing? How you guys doing? Yeah, you know me. I'm just hanging in there. Yeah, we got an interesting game on the docket today. Rogue. Isn't that interesting? Rogue. What is Rogue?
I had in the thumbnail, it was just me like, what? Me holding my hands up in disbelief as looking at the I don't know, like a screenshot of Rogue or something. Whatever floats your boat. Besides the point, welcome back, everybody. Today, we're going to be talking about a 1980s game called Rogue. Which, in its creation, surprisingly, somehow, in some way, sparked a revolution of games like Rogues, which called are roguelikes, which are called roguelikes. I kind of botched the syntax on that sentence there, but you catch my drift. So, without further ado, if you listened or watched my Instagram reel on Independent Incidentals, then you'll know that this game is old. I literally had to download. Well, you couldn't. Here's the thing. If you want to play Rogue today, it's easy. All you have to do is look up Rogue online. Boom. It's right there. Play it in your browser, whatever. Or you can buy it for like $3 on Steam. There's whatever way floats your boat. The Rogue on Steam is probably easier to manage and download and all that kind of stuff. There's even a version on the Switch with updated graphics. If you don't like the ASCII art, which we'll get to in a moment. But what is Rogue? What are we talking about? Dominic, what the hell are you talking about? I hear you ask. I just woke up. It's literally still dark out right now. And I just woke up because I was up until 3 a.m. Working on this final assignment that I have to get done for next week. What's going on? And to you, audience, I'd like to say, please work on your sleep hygiene. I have many fears for you. But besides the point, Rogue is the progenitor, like I said, of many of these roguelikes that have been made today. It was made by two people, Michael Toy and Glenn Wichman, back in the 1980s. It was developed in the late 1970s. So this game is very old. This game is ancient. My father was literally six when this... He was about the same age, to be fair. Somewhere around his late teens when this game came out. So this game is old. Like I said, if you want to play this game on your browser without having to go through the third person aggregate Steam, you have to get a DOSBox emulator. What is a DOSBox, you may ask? Well, that's the old way that games back in the 1980s and 90s used to run these type of games. Now, because obviously games back then were on floppy disks, and you had to load them onto a floppy disk drive, which then interfaced with your DOS box, which then you had to mount inside of the DOS box, and then there's like a specific line command in order to actually run the game. Like, for example, for Rogue, with the emulator, for example, you actually have to, you know, mainly it's way easier nowadays because you just can download the files from the internet, but you still have to drag the file onto the DOSBox emulator. Then from there, you have to type in the command to run the game, which is, in this case, I had to Google it. It was Rogue. You type in Rogue, and then boom, it starts, it boots up, and then, you know, all is fine from there. But Rogue was based on the developers at the time. Go figure. We're really into D&D, Dungeons and Dragons, and also into other text adventures of the time. I think one of them was a 1970-something, 1971, 1976 maybe, text adventure for Star Trek. Another one for a fantasy adventure. I think it's something about a cavern or a cave or some sort. Besides the point, they coded this game in a sea-based engine. And from there, they were able to get within contact with the publisher. They published the game, and then it became a cult classic from then on. Now, here's the thing. This was one of the most popular games for this time, for this era, for most machine systems. Because think about it this way. Back in the 1970s, no one really had a computer. No one was really able to get a hold of a computer because it was very expensive. I think I remember researching back in the 1950s, these machines, if accounted for inflation, would have cost upwards of $100,000. Obviously, in the next 20 years, they obviously brought the price down to, like, I don't know, say $2,000. But for what you're getting, which is 256 kilobytes of memory, for the record, most average systems nowadays have 8 gigabytes. 8 gigabytes, so 1,000 times better, even more so, than what we have, what we had back in the 1980s. I say it like I was born back then, but I wasn't. I wasn't going to be alive until 25 years later. Here's the thing, though. I remember my dad. He had a Windows XP computer back when I was a little kid, back in 2009. And he had a DOSBox emulator. And he was able to play a bunch of these games like Master of Orion, Heroes of Might and Magic, and a bunch of other ones that just kind of that he had kind of collected over the years. Granted, he kind of fell out of it over the years, of course. Because they weren't really up to date with what we had nowadays with these cool graphics and such. But for the time, they were really innovative and very cultivating the culture that came forth from these type of games. Developed their own genres. For example, other games like Civilization, for example, came from this era. Came from the 90s era where they were created on floppy disks, mind you, and published on floppy disks to other people who had these types of systems. Now, I wonder what systems... I forget that the actual publisher of Rogue, which I shall now Google right now. Rogue was actually developed by, yes, Michael Toy and Glenn Wichman. And then Ken Arnold came... Yeah, right. So Ken Arnold came later in the 1984 version. And then they kept remastering and remastering until eventually, you can play it today and all that fun stuff. Of course, there was a bunch of other offshoots during the day as well. Because people, you know, found that the game was limiting. Which I find was very funny. Because you'll now figure out what happened. But other games like NetHack, for example, came from Hack, which came from Rogue. All these games kind of came out of Rogue and kept developing on their own concepts, as we shall now see. Besides the point, EPYX was the publisher of the original 1980s version of Rogue. And from there, the game became open source. You can develop it however you want. People made other games like NetHack and other stuff like that, where they took it to the next level. But besides the point, how does this game progress? How do you even play this game? What is it? Well, the game starts you off with a character. You can name it whatever you want. I usually choose Billy Boy, but, you know, that's... Billy Boy's adventures just roll off the tongue, but you can name him whatever you want. You can name him yourself, you can name him your mom, you can name him your dad, you can name him your sister, brother, dog, right? I won't judge you. Anyway, you start off with the essential adventuring essentials, right? Such as a mace, some arrows, a quiver, a bow, a short bow, and a chainmail. All of these are essential and... All right, we're back. Just making sure the audio is good. We're good. All right. Let's resume what we were talking about before. So, you start out with the essentials for any adventurer. You have a mace, chainmail, a bow that shoots arrows. Who go figure. And that's about it. Because your goal is to adventure through the dungeon, which is laid out through multiple different maps, different layers of this dungeon to look for the MacGuffin, which in this case is the Amulet of Yenrath? Quest for the Amulet? I don't know. I don't know what it's called, audience. Yes, the Amulet of Yendor. The reason why it's called Yendor is because you reverse it. That's the name of one of the Velvers, you know. It doesn't matter. Point is... Rodney, that's what it is. I don't think it's... I think it's just a random name that the developer came up with. I don't think it actually has any significance, per se. But the Amulet of Yendor, a Rodney, in this case. Basically, the idea is you're supposed to explore through this catacomb. The manual has everything. I might put the manual inside of the description for this episode if you want to see it for yourself, but you can just look up Rogue Instruction Manual and see the story unfold for itself. As I plumb the uncharted depths of this dungeon of doom, I wonder, where am I? Is this a passage I've trudged before? Is this the chamber in which I left my cloak of chainmail? Does this wall conceal a trapdoor which I found lost lifetimes ago? Very curious. Now here's the thing, because you're stuck. The story, I guess, is that you're stuck in an infinite loop of time per se, that allows you to keep playing this game over and over and over again, which is one of the staples of Rogue. It is punishing because you have to start the game all over again. There's no checkpoints, no nothing. You can't save the game. If you fail it, it deletes your save file and you have to start all over again. But also, you have to explore the depths, try to figure out where these items are. Now, the gimmick for this game, particularly, is that you don't know what these items do. It is randomly generated each time, procedurally generated. I don't really know the difference. I'll have to look that up as well. But besides the point, procedurally generated content each run playthrough, which allows the game to retain its replay ability, which we've discussed before and time again with FTL and also Slay the Spire, of course. If you want to resume those episodes, you can go to the website for Independent Incidentals and rewatch the episodes, because all of them are up, theoretically. I think up to episode 5 as of this recording. So, catch up, listen to the episodes. Besides the point. So, you trudge through the Dungeon of Doom. What is the goal of the game? The goal is to get to, I think, level 21 and leave with the amulet, right? There's many different strategies to do this, of course, which is another characteristic of these kind of games. You can traverse the depths on your own pace, trying to find the best equipment. Like in this recent playthrough, I found a ring of sea invisibility, which was very handy for no reason, because I haven't found any invisible creatures yet, but I'm sure it'll come in handy eventually if I don't die. Another fun part about this game, right? There's kind of from its text adventure lineage, and there's a whole bunch of different commands you can do within the dungeon, right? So, for example, in a text adventure game, which we kind of also covered during the Frog Fraction / Off episode, there's a bunch of different commands that allow you to do different things. Obviously, traversing is one of them, which this one actually, you know, innovates on, because you don't actually type specifically what direction you go in, but you do type what direction you want to throw, say, an arrow in, or shoot an arrow in. It's very confusing, because, you know, there's... it's a whole bunch of different actions. There's not one single action for one specific item. You have to press Q to quaff something, so drink something. You have to press W to wield something, such as your armor, your bow, your mace, whatever. You have to press E to eat something, because there's also hunger, which is another fun staple of this game. There's a hunger mechanic that makes you, I think, either lose more, or you can just die of starvation. I'm not too sure. I've never died of starvation, so, you know, I'm just built like that. So I wouldn't know. Besides the point. There is also a bunch of other commands. I think capital P makes you can put on something, so you can put on a ring, which I just figured out in one of the before we just started recording this episode. So, you know, if there's any other fun codes, there should be in the manual, which I shall now look up right now. Of course. Hold on. Wait. Should be here somewhere. Should be here somewhere. Hold on. Wait. Wait, hold on. No. It should. This is what I hate about manuals. Okay, here we go. Yes. Here we go. Here's the full command list. So, D allows you to drop something. E allows you to eat food. You can read a scroll. Right. There's other items that are also unknown to you until you use them. So, for example, in this one playthrough, there was a scroll that said, like, Itilimak Selorokinish, right? It's completely encoded to you. You do not know what in the world it does until you read it. And then when you read the script or the scroll, whatever, it unlocks this, or it curses you or gives you a special boon that you can use on your quest. For example, this one allowed me to identify another object. So I identified the ring I had in my inventory, which then I figured out was a ring of sea invisibility. You want to make sure that the objects you're putting on your body aren't, you know, cursed in any specific way. Wouldn't want that on anyone's conscience. Anyway. What else is there to this game? It's very, very difficult. Also very, very anticlimactic because it was the 80s. Cut them some slack. You can't really, you know, build a AAA $100 million budget game from scratch from this era because we didn't have the processing power back then, of course. So your character is represented by either an ASCII symbol or in the 1984 version, which was the one I got my hands on, a little smiley face that kind of just traverses the dungeon. There's little grid spaces, which are represented by little hyphens. And I think there's, like, you know, different walls you can collide into, doors, which are represented by a different slash. They got better with actually, you know, representing these things easier. But it does actually, you know what, I have an idea. Maybe I can recreate a game like this, you know, from scratch. Who knows? Who knows what could happen? I'm learning C next year, so it might be a good idea to get myself familiar with the coding engine. Who knows? But besides the point, that's pretty much all there is to Rogue. There's going to be more things that we're going to discover as we actually delve deep into what an actual roguelike is, per se. But until then, we'll have to stay tuned. So, we don't actually get our definition of a roguelike until 2008, where a bunch of nerds decided to make a conference in Berlin, where I think about, like, I don't know, six people met up, and then there was a Google group, which apparently existed back then, where a bunch, it was basically just like a email chain chat room of the time, 2008, where a bunch of these games were discussed, and mechanics were delved into. Ways to implement those mechanics, and what even in the world is a roguelike to begin with? Because a lot of, like I said, a bunch of these other games started cropping up, like Dwarf Fortress and NetHack and a bunch of others that spanned the test of the 90s and 2000s. So, this is where they came up with the Berlin interpretation, because they met up in Berlin, and it facilitates what people can interpret a roguelike as. It states at the start of the document that it doesn't have to be exactly one-to-one in this context. As we'll soon figure out, these mechanics can be swapped in and out, and you can still have a roguelike. But the more you swap out, the more of what you'll get is called a roguelite. But we'll get to those definitions in a moment. And we'll also see how far this definition can be extended, because there's a lot of wiggle room in this definition that we'll soon see. So, how does it feel? What makes a roguelike? What feels like a roguelike, you know? How does the roguelike feel? Have you ever asked him how does the roguelike feel, Anyway, what elements make a roguelike? What facilitates a roguelike? Well, as I mentioned before, obviously, procedural generation as one of the main staples, main keys of roguelikes. It has to be random on every playthrough. necessarily. We'll see about that. Depends. Depends on what you mean by random and what you mean by procedural, of course. There are some stipulations to this definition. A procedural definition obviously means that the computer, I think, if I'm not mistaken, takes a seed, a randomly generated string of a bunch of letters and numbers, whatever, from the atmospheric pressure in the air and whatever other mechanical things it kind of facilitates in that random computation, and generates a level, a gameplay through an entire run based on this seed. Things like what items are being dropped, what enemies are being spawned, how even the map works. All these are based on this procedural generation. And if you don't have it, every single playthrough is pretty much going to be the exact same, right? That's just the essence of a roguelike. You have to have different playthroughs each time. Each playthrough is going to be unique, in a sense. You catch my drift? Let's move on to the next element of a roguelike. Permadeath. Permadeath, like I said before, is a staple of most of these kind of hard games back in the 80s, and they've kind of made a resurgence nowadays. They made a renaissance, if you will. It all started with these cabinet games that you would have seen back in the cabinets of the 1970s. Pac-Man, for example, you don't get to start at level 5, you start at level 0 and you work your way up again, right? You gotta put another quarter in. It was pretty much a marketing model back in the day. If people were able to start at checkpoints, then you wouldn't have made that much money because they would have beat the game faster. If you start from the beginning, you make more money. But now it's actually facilitated within the actual mechanical essence of a roguelike. Permadeath is important. But not necessarily always needs to be that perma, if you catch my drift. We'll get that out in a second as well. Turn-based. Now, this is where it starts to get a little bit iffy, depending on what roguelike you're more inclined to play. Turn-based games often do facilitate a roguelike kind of style of play, because permadeath requires you to think over your actions. You have to think about what items you keep, what the enemies you hit at a specific time, and with that, you want to make sure you give the player as much time as possible, as much time as needed, in order to make, you know, the decisions more understandable. Do I attack the enemy? Do I run away? You know, those kind of things. With Rogue, for example, you are exploring the dungeon. You have a outlay of the entire map, and you can move around this map. However, the enemies only move when you move. So say, for example, if you move one step that way, that's the only time the enemy can follow you. Turn-based gameplay is another element. Another element is multi-directional. And what I mean by this label, is the idea of there being multiple ways to solve a situation. The game allows the ways to be solved is pretty much, you know, based on the mechanical limitations of the game, right? For example, if I'm in a room with an orc on the opposite side and I need to defeat the orc on the opposite side of the room, right? I could just run up and attack it, which is kind of a faulty move. Or I can use an item in my inventory that could, you know, hopefully destroy the beast. Or I can shoot it from afar. That way it takes a while for him to reach me, and I have a solid amount of arrows that I can reuse over and over again. Multi-directional gameplay allows you to choose which way you're going. Allows you to choose which path you want to take as a player. Each different playthrough is unique, so you're going to have unique solutions each time. And maybe different solutions are going to be more valued than others, more efficient in solving a specific problem. Hack and slash gameplay. You're going to be killing enemies, probably, depending on which game you're playing. Hack and slash basically entails you hacking and slashing enemies. But of course, this gameplay loop can be very rigid, and people have found ways to extend this gameplay loop. Exploration and discovery is another solid gameplay loop. You're going to be exploring a dungeon which is another specific setting that it takes place in roguelikes. Two birds with one stone. You got exploration, figuring out what you're doing in a specific run, and you got a dungeon crawling mechanic, because it is a dungeon crawler. You are crawling through a dungeon. You're slogging through the depths and trying to pick up equipment. Now, here's the thing. These seven different elements that make up rogue don't always have to make up a roguelike. Like I said before, the Berlin interpretation is exactly that. It is an interpretation of what needs to be there to be classified as a roguelike. But you can still facilitate the same feeling of a roguelike even though you have swept some of the elements. Like, for example, what if we had the exact same gameplay, right? You go through dungeons, you explore different mechanics, you try to pick up items, and they might be procedurally generated, and procedurally generated rooms also, right? But let's make the turn-based combat into real-time combat. Let's make it so that you actually have to use your reflexes, your gamer reflexes, in order to stay, survive in the dungeon, right? Well, it sounds like you just made a Binding of Isaac, right? Interesting. Let's put the turn-based back, right, for now. And let's take, instead of having hack-and-slash gameplay, or specifically, you know, actual, you know, mechanical gameplay where you have to use items, let's replace those with cards. Let's make it a deck-building game where you have to have a specific type of deck, and you have to use that deck to attack monsters, for example, right? Sounds like you made Slay the Spire. Interesting. Now let's keep the turn-based combat. Let's turn the dungeon into a multifaceted galaxy, each with their own special sectors, and have a specific encounter on each sector of the map. Well, it sounds like you made into... What's that game called? Faster Than Light, thank you. These are all games that I've covered, but they all have their own unique mechanics. However, they're universally classified as a roguelike. Isn't that interesting? Now, obviously, you can turn these different mechanical elements however you like. But the problem facilitates itself when you get to a Ship of Theseus problem. How many elements can you take out of the game to turn it into a roguelike? Can you classify Minecraft hardcore mode as a roguelike? Think about it. Permadeath, because you are on hardcore mode, right? Procedural generation, because you made the map. It's always procedurally generated that after each playthrough, after each run. You can obviously turn there's many games that turn the turn-based combat into real-time combat, so let's do that, right? Multi-directional, you can pick multiple different paths. You can make your own base however you like. Hack-and-slash gameplay. You do hack-and-slash monsters and ghoulies and zombies and skeletons and the sort, right? You explore dungeons in the game? Minecraft hardcore mode is a roguelike. But it doesn't feel like a roguelike, does it? How about a more egregious example? How about we take Fortnite? We're getting crazy now, aren't we? We're going a little bit lunatic. We're going a bit insane right now. Can we turn Fortnite into a roguelike? The maps aren't procedurally generated, though. You do have permadeath, technically. However, there is a bit of a mechanic there. Here's the thing. It is hack and slash gameplay, because even though you're using a gun, you're still hacking and slashing other opponents in the game. You're exploring different assortments of the layout, the map, per se. It doesn't have to be a dungeon, per se, of course. But you're getting different items each time, and you're using these items to use to your advantage. You're obviously using multi-directional problem solving to understand and assess what you have to do, where you have to go. The procedural element is more so laid out in the storm locations, and the permadeath is finicky in a way, isn't it? Because you can obviously use the reboot van to reboot your teammates. But when you die, and all your teammates die, you die for good, and you have to restart the game. Sounds like a roguelike, doesn't it?
But it isn't! How do we classify these roguelikes?
Well, here's the thing. The two main core tenets of a roguelike, what makes it feel like a roguelike, in my personal opinion, are the procedural element and the permadeath element, right? We could obviously talk about all these other elements as they were, but there are more just kind of features to them. And the Berlin interpretation even adds extra non-useful ones. Like, for example, ASCII display. It's the modern era. We don't need an ASCII display anymore. You know, it doesn't have to be a tiled environment anymore. We can extend from that. So ASCII display is pretty much obsolete. Numbers are also kind of there, but that's pretty much every game. So, you know, not really that descriptive. So we leave it out. That leaves us with these seven different mechanics, but only the first two, procedural generation and permadeath, are the real deal breakers. They're the ones that actually allow the game to exist as a roguelike. And if one of these games kind of breaks the tenet, it doesn't really feel like a roguelike. Like Fortnite, for example. You obviously have to go through several runs of a game to win, per se, right? But the map is the exact same. There's no real procedural element except for the storm locations and the items. The items are pretty much all set in stone as well, based on the season. So you're not really going to get that much rogue-like feel in Fortnite. How about Minecraft, for example? Obviously, there's a bunch of different mechanics that could make it a roguelike, but the original core game allows you to restart. Allows you to play the exact same seed, but from, you know, having no items. But you still keep your base, you keep everything else. Obviously, these things can erode over time by damn creepers and etc., etc. But the core gameplay, without using hardcore mode, is not a roguelike. We can assess that based on these first two tenets. However, you could argue that hardcore mode is a roguelike. Sure, why not? The save file gets deleted afterwards, exactly, and you get procedural generation each time. But you feel like the game has to be kind of contained within this kind of, you know, layout, right? For Slate of Spire, for example, or Into the Breach, or even Faster Than Light, there's like these kind of mechanical maps that you have to face these set encounters, right? It feels predictable in a way, but at the same time it doesn't, because there's these encounters get reshuffled and reestablished each time, each with their own specific unique challenges. Minecraft is pretty open-ended. You can do anything. You don't have to win the game. So there's no real roguelike challenge to the game, even though it has pretty much checks most of these boxes, per se. So, with that out of the way, I would like to propose a different definition of what these roguelikes could interpret and how you could kind of grade them on a scale of how close they are to rogue and how far away they are from rogue. Let's face it, no one's playing Rogue nowadays, right? So we need to have a way to kind of branch out from Rogue and move on to identifying these terms. You have traditional roguelike, and roguelite. So Rogue, the light version of Rogue, roguelite, right? So traditional roguelikes are the exact definition of they are pretty much an offshoot of rogue. They have the procedural element, they have permadeath, turn-based, multi-directional, hack and slash, exploration and discovery, and they are a dungeon crawler. And even extra cookies, extra points if you want to make it top-down, grid-based, and also more points to you if you want to make it exactly RPG mechanics as well. Because I feel like that's kind of what they more so meant by based in numbers, based in stats, based in mechanical things you can increase and decrease, right? Incremental stats, statistics, whatever you want to call it. Procedural generation and permadeath are the two main things that make up a roguelike, right? Permadeath means that you completely get rid of your save file and you start again. Or basically you have the same save file, but it doesn't carry over anything from the previous save. Procedural generation basically means that every run has to be unique. There should be pretty much, if you are going through a run, there should be no other run that ever existed in the world that has ever been like that before. And you can easily achieve this by making different map layouts, different encounters, different items that could appear in different shops, etc., etc. Slight as Fire, for example, does this perfectly by making the layouts completely different, branching different paths, and you have to think, where am I going? What am I doing? Should I go to those rest points to upgrade my cards, or maybe sleep? Or maybe even go to the shop? Who knows, right? But a roguelike doesn't necessarily have to have the other mechanics, right? It can trade out the turn-based, for example, for action, like in Enter the Gungeon. Or it can trade out the hack and slash for example, cards. Who knows, right? The world's your oyster. And roguelikes are completely flexible in this regard. But how about a roguelike? I feel like a roguelike in this context kind of breaks the element of what a roguelike is, which is procedural and permadeath, right? Take Hades, for example. You obviously have all the other hack and slash gameplay, dungeon crawling, exploration, give or take. Multidirectional, kind of, sort of. But the main thing that it kind of breaks in this context is permadeath. Because even though the dungeons are procedurally generated, A, you can get a copy of the same dungeon. Which is kind of the similar case in, say, Spelunky, for example, or even Binding of Isaac. But permadeath is not necessarily perma, because you still can still upgrade stuff in this sort of hub world, the House of Hades, that you can return to, use your points to upgrade your mechanical skills, and get farther in your runs. So in this context, it isn't a roguelike anymore. It's a roguelite. It doesn't matter, though, because really, who cares about all this defining? Who cares, right? Well, I care, all right? I'm the one who cares. Because here's the thing. Obviously, people are going to be uppity no matter how you slice something. Some people say, who cares? It's a roguelike no matter what, as long as it has these kind of elements, right? As long as it's somewhat procedural, as long as it's somewhat permadeath, it doesn't matter, right? But once we get to the sticky territory of patents and marketing, and how are we going to try to outreach this sort of game to the audience that wants to consume them? How do we do that without making specific definitions of these mechanical structures that make these type of games? If we don't set this in stone, how are we supposed to offshoot it and grow from it, right? We're getting into a time where these games are kind of reiterating on the same mechanical structures that they've been kind of perpetrating for the past, I don't know, 10 years. The live services model, for example, has been kind of, you know, done to death, and I feel like should be in its grave right now. But they keep bringing it out, and they keep doing experiments on it. So who knows? Maybe Concord will get back on the Steam library page in a moment. But until then, we need to make sure that these games also have the same definitional categorization, because at the end of the day, they are also games in their own right. And we should treat them as such. So they should get their own genres. They should be able to be labeled. They should be able to have their own name, their own namesake, right? Obviously, we shouldn't distinguish between them in a way, because that seems a bit unfair to them. But these games have to be categorized. If you're looking for a roguelike game and you don't get a roguelike game, how do you feel, right? It's those kind of niche, aesthetical choices in labeling a product that makes the consumer more happy. So, at the end of the day, is this how the business works, baby? This is how it's going to go. So, how are you going to do it, right? Is your game a traditional roguelike? Is it a roguelike, or is it a roguelite? It's all up to you at the end of the day. Just make sure that you label it properly and that your player base feels like it's whatever you label it. Anyway, that is the episode for today. I hope you all enjoyed it, because I sure did. It was fun to research about these kind of old games, these old niche games that don't really get that much attention nowadays, even though they make the entire genre, even though they uphold the entire industry, right? So easy in design, yet so sleek in their gameplay, right? But besides the point, I shall head out now with a few songs, of course. I will also detail you the songs that I was that I played before here. So if you want to listen to them after this episode has been recorded, you can. And you can give them all the love and attention they deserve.
So,
let's end it on a high note. Why not? Little rocking out, little crazy, but also a little mellow in some senses. We'll start with Deep Space, battle theme by Ben Prunty, the Faster Than Life soundtrack. We're hopefully going to get Into the Breach game episode eventually, but I'll have to ask my roommate about that again, because they're the only people who play the game. Well, I know one more person who plays the game, but I don't know if she's going to be available at this time. So we'll see. I'll get in touch with people. We'll see if we can finally have a guest episode. But until then, I played at the start Drink and Industry by Dabu, the Dwarf Fortress soundtrack, which I mentioned a few times in this episode. Slay the Spire. I've been playing this game way too much, by the way. I finally beat Ascension 19 with the defect. I'm on to Ascension 20. Wish me luck. It's going to be like ripping my toenails from my feet. But I'm going to get it done eventually. I just have to get through all the other bull I have to get through within the time span. So we'll see how it goes. We'll see how it goes. And On the Coast by Darren Korb. I have another Darren Korb song, which was from the Hades soundtrack, of course. In The Unseen Ones, which I'll play at the very end. We also got Deep Space, Iniquity Row from the Into the Breach soundtrack, both by Ben Prunty, and Darren Korb by The Unseen Ones, also starring Masahiro Aoki and Daisuke Kurosawa in their fantastically proficient guitar playing. So, I'll leave you with those. I hope you have a fantastic week. I think there's going to be one more episode, and then I'll be off for the fun Christmas break. So, I hope you all have, I hope you all have room for one more, just one more episode. Episode 9 is going to be a good one, hopefully. We'll see how it goes. Anyway, I'll see you all later. Bye-bye.